Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
Times for us, I think, as we look in an in-depth verse-by-verse study of what happened to our Lord during this Passion Week. And now we've come to the conclusion of the garden experience, and Judas is about to come. And tonight we're going to deal with the arrest of Jesus, and deal with the trial before Caiaphas and denials of Peter. The outlines I've tried to get a bit more technical, but it wouldn't fit on one sheet if I got all the words I want to deal with, so I hope the outline is nothing but a guide for you. I hope you use these to take notes on. If you don't take notes, these outlines won't mean very much 3, 4, 5, 6 months in the future. They'll just be words again. But if you put a comment about what the word means or why I mentioned it here, or if you answer the question as we go through, then these outlines will be a very helpful thing for you. I'm not going to read the text tonight because John 18 is a parallel in many ways and adds other material. As I think you probably know, hopefully before you come on Sunday night, you read what we're going to study. You won't know exactly what verses, but you can know that about where we are as far as the 14th and 15th chapters. So I'm going to begin at verse 43. And I want you to go with me phrase by phrase tonight, if we could. And at that moment, while he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12. Now, Judas, one of the 12, has been mentioned three times in the last few verses. It astonished the early church that the betrayer of Christ was one of the apostles. Judas was an apostle. And it's staggering that he could have been with Jesus so often, so intimately, and even been had the extra responsibility of being the treasurer of the group, and yet he's the one that comes and betrays Jesus. It mentions here that a crowd of men with swords and clubs from the high priest and the elders. Now, John 18:6 is the only place it mentions when Jesus walks out to meet them and says, "Who are you looking for?" That this group of Roman soldiers and temple police fall to the ground backwards in his presence. Friend, Jesus wasn't captured. He's in complete control of the situation. But he goes to see him. Now, the crowd of men has been a great controversy. And as I was reading, why so many men? Now, John says a Roman cohort. Now, a Roman cohort is 600 men. I don't believe 600 men came out. How many, we don't know. But the man who was in charge of those 600 men, plus many, many men came. Why, you say? Well, it's the Passover season. Jerusalem has swelled to three times its normal population. There is a great volatile nationalism running in the streets of Jerusalem now. Many riots have occurred in years past and occurred in the future during this time of festival. Great nationalistic fever. And so they wanted to get Jesus away from the crowds, away from the group, and they did that in the garden. Now, this group is made up of several people. We find out from John chapter 18, verses 3 and 12, that the Roman cohort was there. And if you'll look in verse 44, when it says that Jesus was going to kiss him, give him a signal because they did not know who it was, that says that the signal was not for the Jewish temple police who were also there, but for the Roman soldiers. For the temple people should have known who Jesus looked like. And the other group there was this temple police, these Levites who weren't priests, but who did some of the lesser jobs. And one of these was policing the grounds. The high priest and the Jewish officials had some police authority in and around Jerusalem. You get that from the idea down in verse 49 when Jesus says to this crowd, "Day after day I used to be with you teaching in the temple." Now, they're not talking about Romans there, are they? They're talking about the temple police. Again, Luke 22:52 says that a large number of the Sanhedrin were there, for Jesus addresses the Sanhedrin that night in the garden. So this was a large crowd. Romans, temple police, Levites, and a large number of the Sanhedrin itself were there in that garden that night. There were a lot of other folks there, too. The rabble of the streets that saw them going probably followed. The young man that was there in the linen sheet, we don't know who he was for anything, was there. The 12 was there. So there's a large... there was a lot of folks in that garden that night. And the scene was one of panic. I don't know if you watch the late movies sometimes. I get a kick out of some of those things. Dracula always scares me. I don't watch it. I watch Frankenstein, you know, and the pictures of how they chase the Wolfman with all the torches through the night. Well, that's kind of what it was like this night. Torches there, people screaming, people talking, running around, you know. It was really a confusion time. It says they came with swords and clubs. Now, the sword here, the Greek word means a short sword, a sword carried in a scabbard, not the big Roman sword that they fought with, a short sword. Peter had one of those swords. So we can't say it's just the Romans, because many people were armed. All of the people called the zealots, the assassins, were armed with these short swords. They came with clubs. Now, clubs, I don't know if you've noticed that at the hospital sometimes, the police can't carry guns there, but they carry those long nightsticks. Well, that's what the temple police carried. They got the idea from rabbinic interpretation of Scripture that a Levite couldn't shed blood. They just bludgeon them to death, you know. Just don't break the skin kind of thing. And so they carried these nightsticks, and that's what these people came with, swords and clubs, and John adds torches. And notice they came from the high priest, the scribe, and the elders. Now, that is the official full designation of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council of the Jews, 71, the Supreme Court of Jewish authority. We find this same thing mentioned in Mark chapter 8, verse 31. Now, notice where it says here, "Now his betrayer had given them a signal, a sign, saying, 'The one that I kiss is he. Seize him and lead him away.'" Now, this great big sob story for poor Judas. He was so trapped by circumstances, and he loved Jesus to the end. He came up and kissed him affectionately, and he's so misunderstood. Baloney with that. Judas says, "When I kiss him, you grab him and tie him up. Take him away." This little phrase is a real insight into the motive of Judas. He had seen Jesus go through crowds and not be detected. He had seen people try to stone Jesus, but Jesus get away. He's saying, "You make sure that when I point him out, you get him. You get him, and you get him quick. And then you tie him up, put him in handcuffs, and take him away." So don't give me this poor Judas noise. Now, notice in verse 45 where it says, "So he came and went straight up to Jesus and said, 'Teacher, rabbi, master,'" those are all equivalent, "'and with my translation, has much affection kissed him.'" The verb here is aorist, but it has a preposition that adds intensity. It's the idea of he smothered him with kisses. Oh, yuck. And Jesus took all that knowing. Some say that the reason that Jesus, I'm going to get Judas and Jesus mixed up all night so you'll know who I'm talking about. The reason that Judas did that to Jesus was to keep his mouth shut from calling out to the other disciples. If he kept kissing him around the mouth, he couldn't talk. Now, I don't know if that's it, but it does seem strange that the verb here is kissing with much affection, isn't it, for the sign of betrayal. Some other accounts, Jesus said some things to Judas. He says, see if I can find it here real quick. Yeah, in Matthew 26:50, Jesus says, "Friend, get on with what you're doing." And then in Luke 22:48, Jesus said to Judas, "Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss, Judas?" So I think even yet, Jesus is trying to strike home this man's heart, even at this late hour, saying, "Judas, don't you realize what you're doing?" But he did not. A kiss was a common way to greet a rabbi, but not kissing with great affection, that was not. Now, notice that we're down in verse 46, "And they laid hands on him to arrest him, but one of the bystanders drew a sword and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his ear." We find from John 18:10, it was Peter. And we should have known it would be him. And the high priest's ear from John, we find out, is Malchus. And Luke tells us, John tells us that he cut off the right ear. Luke 22:51 tells us that Jesus put it back. Now, friends, I want you to picture the garden here. They've come to capture a person they think is a heretic and a renegade. They've come with a great amount of force, a lot of men. One man puts up a struggle, and Jesus says, "Don't do that. I must drink the cup my Father has given me to drink." And so he puts his sword back in his sheath. And then Jesus reaches down on the ground, picks up the right ear of the high priest's slave, and puts it back on. What do you think that did for the rest of Malchus' life? What do you think that did to the crowd that night?
that the man they came to arrest is the man who healed the wound and put the ear back on. Friends, Jesus is in control. There was no faith on Malchus's part for the healing of the ear. Think about that. No faith involved at all. It was a sign of Jesus' power. Can you imagine through the years what that man must have thought about Jesus? Can you imagine? That'd be a good one for the movies to do. Of course, they'd ham it up. Now, notice, if you would, in verse 48 where it says, "And Jesus spoke and said to them, Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were a robber?" Now, there's an interpretive account of the word here. Some think it means an assassin, this zealot. And day after day, verse 49, "I used to be teaching in the temple. You never laid hands on me there." He's saying, "You could have got me any time. Why did you come to the garden like this with all these men armed to the teeth? Who did you think you were coming after anyway?" And then he adds this account, "But this is to fulfill Scriptures." Now, what is to fulfill Scriptures? The treachery of Judas? No, I really think that this little phrase, that "to fulfill Scripture," is related to the paragraph that follows when it says, "And all the disciples forsook him." That's Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. "Strike the shepherd, and the sheep scatter." So, even in the midst of this, there is fulfillment of prophecy. Notice it says, "And all disciples forsook him." Now, that's hard to understand for just a little bit. The same sequence in John that Vernon read, in John 18, 15, and 16, John has come back, and he is with Jesus in the high priest's house. Now, there is a bit of controversy over the exact order of these trials. John tells us he went to Ananias first. The synoptic gospels tell us that Jesus was drugged before Caiaphas, and then before Pilate, and then before Herod, and then before Pilate again. And we don't know the exact chronological sequence of when and where exactly. But I want you to notice that John is with Jesus before Caiaphas, and that Caiaphas knows John and lets John in, and John has to go back and get Peter in the gate. "I know this guy, let him in." So Peter, even though he ran then, comes back very quickly following at a distance. And John recovers very quickly and is with Jesus at the trial. And he is the only one that we know of was with Jesus at the crucifixion. That's what Jesus says, "John, behold thy mother." And there's one more that didn't run away that night. Who is that? That's the man with the linen sheet. He was following even closer than the disciples were following and almost got arrested for it. So the prophecy is fulfilled. They left, but some of them came back very, very quickly to be with Jesus at his side. Notice it said they took him, made their escape, and a young man was following with only a linen sheet. Now, a lot of folks say this is John Mark, or the writer of the Gospel of Mark. I think we're reading too much into this. We assume that the Last Supper was at John's house. That's an assumption. We can't prove it any way in the world. We assume that John was there when Judas came to find Jesus and he wasn't there and that John followed him. That's all an assumption. We assume that this, because it's mentioned here and it doesn't seem very important, that Mark's just adding a little personal touch. That's an assumption. We don't know who this young man was. We know a couple of things about him. Number one, he was dressed in haste, for all he had was a linen sheet around him. Number two, he was a wealthy person, because linen sheets were not the most common thing. It'd be like having a satin sheet around us or something in our day. So he's wealthy, and he dressed in a hurry, and he wants to follow Jesus. And the crowd had let the disciples go, but suddenly they turned ugly, and this guy kept following. I'm sure they were still nervous. And they kept looking and looking. Finally, one of them tries to grab him, and he leaves the sheet and run. The first New Testament streaker. You didn't know streaking was biblical, did you? Many have said, "Well, he just lost his topper garment." No, the old boy's naked here. And he's running. I don't know where you run. Boy, woo! That's worse than some of those college deals about initiations into those different groups, isn't it? I would hate to be dropped off at shallow water with nothing on, wouldn't you, in the middle of the night? Mercy, I just would not join something if I had to go through all that. Well, anyway, that's a bit of a rabbit. Seized him, but he left the linen sheet behind and fled away naked. Now you say, "Well, why would anybody add that? That's just so mundane, and that doesn't sound right." Look up Amos 2:16. Could it be that even this incident is fulfilled prophecy? Amos 2:16 talks about in the day of judgment that even the mighty men of valor are going to flee from the presence of that day naked. Could it be that even this little account, inserted at some think almost as an afterthought, is really the fulfillment of prophecy? Amos 2:16. Now, notice again, if you would, in verse 53, where it says, they forsook Jesus and took him to the high priest. Now, this is where John 18:12 says they took him to Ananias first. Ananias was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest. Ananias was apparently the power behind the throne. And so many think that there is an interlude between verse 52 and verse 53 in the synoptic account. I just don't know. It's hard to say. Now, took him to the high priest, that's Caiaphas, and all the high priest, plural, which means members who used to be high priests or members of their family, elders. Now, elders are lay leaders from the Jerusalem area. Scribes, those are trained lawyers and interpreting the Old Testament, most of them Pharisees, some of them Sadducees. That's the designated for the whole Sanhedrin. Now, verse 54 is added in a way to say, while this is happening to Jesus over here, at the same time, this is happening to Peter outside. So it's an inserted verse to kind of show the contemporary setting of both things happening at the same time. So here we have verse 54. And Peter followed a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, apparently Caiaphas. I don't think he was there for Ananias. I don't think John was there for Ananias. So I think John left for a while too. And there was sitting with the attendants. Now, the word attendants here in verse 54 is the same word that's used in verse 65 where the high priest and the Sadducees and all the Sanhedrin get through abusing Jesus, turn him over to the attendants who took charge of him with slaps or beat him in the face also. Now, this Greek word is a word that means the slaves that row in the lower deck of a Roman trimarine, which is their big ships with three decks of oars. It is the lowest kind of slave. Now, what it's talking about is, this is a designation for the Levite underlings who are the temple police. Okay? These are the temple police, what it's talking about. The attendants, and he was warming himself there before the fire. It's a spring night. It's cold. And Peter is there. Now, look at verse 55. We're going back to the trial. Just one little verse, kind of to show the time setting. Back to the trial. And the high priest and the whole council. Now, I don't think it was the whole council. I don't think that Joseph Arimathea was there. I don't think Nicodemus was there. Probably even Gamaliel was not there. But isn't it strange? Now, think with me. We see the whole council's there. We see that false witnesses were there. Friends, how did they know that Jesus was going to be arrested that night? These folks had been on standby for several nights now. They had planned to get Jesus, and tonight happened to be the night. But the witnesses were ready. The messengers were ready to go get the rest of Sanhedrin. This is well planned. This is not spontaneity. This is well planned. Now, that's what happens. In verse 55, 56, there is three different verb tenses in the imperfect, which means continuous action in past time. They did this over and over again these few next few minutes. Listen to them. We're trying, could not find, gave false testimony, are all three imperfect. They kept trying to get evidence. They kept being hindered from getting the evidence, and the false witnesses kept on talking, kept on telling their false statements. Over and over they'd tell the story, trying to get it right. Now, notice what it says, trying to get evidence against Jesus to put him to death. Back in Mark 14:1, it says they had determined that he must die. So this is not a fair trial. This is a mock trial. They know the verdict. They're just trying to find something to back the verdict up. Notice again, they said they could not find any evidence. For although many gave false testimonies against him, their testimonies did not agree. Now this is where our study of Deuteronomy and our study of the Gospels dovetail. Deuteronomy 17:6, Deuteronomy 19:15 say, you cannot convict a man except by the testimonies of two witnesses. The Old Testament also says that if a witness comes and is proved to be false in a murder trial, that the witness must bear the penalty of the accused. These witnesses should have been killed. It was obvious they were lying. It was obvious they were out with the wrong motives. But it's also obvious that the judges also have the wrong motives, and the false witnesses go free, though it's obvious they are purging themselves. Look at verse 57. Some took the witness stand and gave their testimony, saying, "We ourselves heard him say, I will tear down this temple built with man's hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. That's not what Jesus said at all. The first place, the Greek word here they're quoting is the Greek word to describe the temple itself, the holy of holy building. The word that Jesus used in John 19 through 21 is the larger term that describes the whole temple area, including the walls and the porticos and all. So even the Greek word for the temple is misquoted. Jesus never said, tear it down and I'll build it back without hands. He never said none of that. Now, he did mention this quote in dealing, we learn later, about his own death, burial, and resurrection. He did mention about the temple being destroyed to the disciples in John, in Mark 13, but he never said it this way. But even in this matter, their testimony did not agree. Verse 16, the high priest arose in their midst. Now, you get the picture. Get the picture with me. They're in Caiaphas' house. The Sanhedrin met 71 of them on a raised horseshoe platform, raised up off the floor. And there were big seats, you know. And all these guys would be seated there, their legs crossed, looking very pious and holy. And in the middle was the accused placed. A little chair was placed in the middle. And the accused came inside the horseshoe and sat down. The high priest, of course, would have been at the head of the horseshoe. He couldn't find anything to, as far as witnesses to condemn him. So the high priest gets frustrated. And he gets off his chair and he walks to the middle of the room. Now catch the picture. There's so much injustice here. Jewish prudence never would allow a man to incriminate himself. And that's exactly what the high priest is going to ask Jesus. So the high priest arose in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? Nothing. Jesus says nothing. What about this testimony they are giving against you? But he kept silent and made no answer. Please put CF, Isaiah 53:7. He goes on. So the high priest again questioned him. We learn from Matthew 26:63 that the high priest walked up to Jesus in a murder trial and said, I abjure you by the living God. Now what he's saying is, I'm putting you under oath. If you were a sincere Christian and someone asked you to put your hand on the Bible and swear, friend, you just would not lie. That's the same kind of thing this high priest, and he's saying, I'm putting you under the oath of God to tell the truth. That's what he's doing, okay? Question in these words, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, what's he asking? The word Christ should not be there. He's asking him, are you the Messiah? Now, the Christ is a Greek translation of this, but this is a Jewish context. He didn't use the word Christ. He said, are you the Anointed One? Are you the coming one? Are you the one we're expecting? Are you the Messiah? And then he used a little phrase which says, the Son of the Blessed One. I don't know if you've read much Jewish documents, but they refer to God over and over as the Holy One, blessed be He, like that. They never use His name. They're afraid to take the name in vain. They call Him the Holy One, blessed be He. That's their name for God. Now, some say that since the Jews did not expect a God to come, they expected a man, that what he's asking Jesus is, are you the Messiah, with no connotation of deity. Now, it is very true that the Jews were not expecting the Messiah to be superhuman. They were expecting him maybe to have some superhuman powers given by God, but they were not expecting God in the form of a man. To a Jew, to say God was going to have a son was to go against monotheism. The Greeks had all these gods marrying women. That was these Canaanite things. These Baal worshippers. For a Jew, God would never have a son, you see. They couldn't fathom that. So they were not expecting God incarnate. So I think historically we can say that he's not asking, are you divine? But we must look at some of the things that Jesus said in his ministry that the Jews reacted to. If you'll notice John chapter 5, verse 18, and John chapter 10, verse 30 and 33, in those two accounts, the Jews were ready to kill Jesus because they said, he claims to be God. So I'm not sure if the high priest did not have in this question more than simple messiahship, but he was saying, are you the Messiah and do you also claim to be God? I think some of that's involved here. Now, he put him right on the spot. He asked him the question, no bones about it. And Jesus answered with no bones about it. Jesus said, I am he. What automatically bingos in your mind when Jesus says, I am? Man, all through the Gospel of John, he says, I am the good shepherd. I am the door of the sheepfold. I am the living water. I am the bread of life. On and on he goes. What? Something ought to just knock you down when you hear that. Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. The first time God ever told anybody what his covenant name is. Moses said, who should I tell him is sending me? And God said, say, I am that I am, or it's the Hebrew word for being, yada. In that linear tense of being, what he was saying is, Yahweh, I am that I am, or I will be what I will be, or something like that. Jesus is using the very same self-designation for himself that God used for Moses in Exodus 3:14. I am, that's what he says. Boy, the high priest had a fit. No, but Jesus didn't quit there. He said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of the sky. First of all, the little phrase, Son of Man. This is a phrase that comes from Daniel chapter 7 and also from the book of Ezekiel. To me, this is the clearest phrase, the only possible phrase that combines the superhuman qualities of Daniel 7 with the humanity of Ezekiel. When God says Ezekiel, he says, Son of Man, stand on your feet. I want to talk to you. All through the book of Ezekiel, the Son of Man is a word for human being. Stand up. But in the book of Daniel, the word Son of Man is used for this great human figure that comes before the Ancient of Days and receives the eternal kingdom. So I think very use of the word Son of Man is the idea of deity and humanity somehow together. And then he says, seated at the right hand. Man, those Jews knew their Old Testament. Not too many hours before, Jesus had put them down significantly in saying, in quoting Psalms 110. And this thing about sitting at the right hand of God comes from Psalms 110, and it's a messianic psalm. He's claiming to be God. He's saying, you'll see me sitting at the right hand. Now, my translation has the Almighty, but it's the word power, dunamis in Greek. Now, this he was saying, you'll see me in the number one place of authority. Man, the Jews couldn't believe it. He wasn't saying he's going to be with God. He's saying, I'm going to be God's authority figure. Be God's right arm, if you please. But he didn't quit there. Coming in the clouds of heaven, definitely, Daniel 7:13. This is the picture of deity. Deity rides in the clouds. Deity is in the Shekinah glory. Deity is always accompanied with the smoke and fire of the presence of God. And lo and behold, Jesus is coming on the symbol of deity in the Old Testament for God. That high priest choked. He took his garments and he ripped them. He ripped the outside one and the inside one right in front of his chest, which is a sign, used to be a sign of weeping in the Old Testament, but later in Judaism became a symbol of being in the presence of blasphemy. Now, tore his clothes, verse 63. What more evidence do we need now? Did you hear his own blasphemy? Look at Leviticus 24:14 through 16. The penalty for blasphemy is death by stoning. That's what he's saying. Condemn him. He deserves to die. And suddenly started to spit on him and blindfold him. Now, what's happening here? Is this just a derision? Is there some meaning here in Judaism? Yes, there is great meaning in Judaism. To spit in someone's face is not just to be nasty. It had great meaning in the Old Testament. I'll give you some examples. Let me see here. Numbers 12:14, Deuteronomy 25:9, Job 30:10, Isaiah 56. When there was to be a Levite marriage where a man died and didn't have any children, the brother was supposed to marry her. If that nearest kin wouldn't marry her, they were to go to the elders of the city at the gate. He was to take off one of his sandals and give it to her, and she was to spit in his face in front of all the assembled people, and that was a sign that he was rejected. Friends, this spitting in the face is an Old Testament sign of anger, hatred, and rejection. You say, what about the blindfolding? Isaiah 11:3 talks about that God will not judge with his eyes. And rabbinical interpretation of this says that one way to prove who the Messiah is, that the Messiah would be able to judge by his smell and not by his sight or by his hearing. Matter of fact, in the Jewish rebellion of Bar Kokhba, which is a huge Jewish rebellion later on from Jesus, the way they finally killed him is said, they blindfolded him and said, prophesy. And he couldn't, and they killed him. For you see, the Jews had used this Isaiah 11:3 as a test for messiahship. And so here they blindfold Jesus, and they smash him in the face and say, Now, you're the Messiah. Tell us who just hit you. And the picture is the whole Jewish Sanhedrin, these great men of wisdom and dignity, come off their seats now and begin to smack this man who is handcuffed in the face and say, tell us who hit you, Smolik. You're so hot. You're the Messiah. Tell us who hit you. And they continued to beat him with their fist. And even the attendants, when the Sanhedrin got tired, did the same thing. So Jesus is a bloody pulp at this time, not later. Now, we go back in verse 66 to Peter. Peter was down the courtyard with one of the high priest waiting girls. Now, if I told you that Matthew had two girls, would it surprise you that Mark had one, Matthew had two? One characteristic we've seen all the way through this synoptic deal is that Mark always has one, Luke always has one, and Matthew always has two Gadarene demoniacs, two blind men, two this, two that. Same thing holds true here. Matthew in Matthew 26, 69, and 71 has two waiting girls. Mark seems to only have one. Now, the waiting girl came up. From John 18, 17, we realize this was the girl that was keeping the gate that night. And John knew the high priest, and this girl knew he knew the high priest, so she let John in, but wouldn't let Peter in. And John had to go back to the girl and say, he's with me, let him in. And so he only got in the inside the courtyard that night. Now let's picture a Jewish house, be a little better. There is a big fence here with a large archway. There is an inner courtyard, much along the lines of Spanish-style architecture today. There are rooms along this side and rooms along that side. The trial is going up on the second story. Down below in the middle of this open courtyard is the place the soldiers are. There's a fire down there, usually water fountains and that kind of thing, okay? And this is the high priest's house. It had been a fancy house with open courtyard. Peter's down there in the courtyard, okay? He's warming himself by a cold fire. First of all, it's a full moon. How do I know it's a full moon? It's a full moon because Passover. Peter is standing by this fire warming himself. The light from the fire is glowing on his face. It's a full moon. And one of these servant girls come over and look at him and say, you were with Jesus, weren't you? Boy, Peter gets nervous. No. I don't understand what you're even talking about. I didn't quite get you. I don't understand at all. So he just says, I don't know what you're talking about. He went out to the courtyard and was in the gateway. Friends, Peter's not just walking around. Peter was trying to hook him. He was heading for the door outside. But the girl at the door again says, yeah, you're one of them. Peter was leaving, and he got cut off at the pass. She says, I recognize you. So Peter turns back around from the gate going outside and heads back into the courtyard, okay? And look at verse 69. The waiting girl saw him there and began to tell the bystander, this fellow is one of them. And he denied it again. And then a few minutes later, now Luke 22:59 says, an hour later, Peter's trapped in the courtyard for I don't know how long, but friends, he's nervous now. Talk about a cat in a hot tin roof. Peter's hopping around the courtyard of the high priest. And the bystanders begin to say to Peter, surely you're one of them. You are a Galilean. Now, number one, the Galilean speech is kind of like, you can tell when somebody's from Mississippi, can't you? Sure you can. They've lived there. They just have an accent. And you can tell when somebody's from Massachusetts. I never heard Cuber said that way by anybody but Kennedy and people from Massachusetts. There's characteristics of speech, and Galileans did not pronounce their guttural syllables as well as the people in Jerusalem did. They pegged this guy for the way he talked. Said, you're a Galilean. So they got two evidence. They said, one, they say you talk like a Galilean. Surely you're one of his. And from John chapter 18, verse 26, one of the relatives of Malchus, the high priest, is there and said, didn't I see you? Well, quote, yeah, he saw him. He cut his relative's ear off. He looked real well at that boy. So here Peter has really got trapped. He's got his language against him. He's got the two servant girls that saw him with Jesus. And he's got the relative of Malchus saying, yes, you're with him. And here's how Peter comes across after that. He's pretty well trapped. And he says, then he commenced cursing and swearing. I do not know this man you're talking about. Wouldn't even mention Jesus' name. Just says, this man. Now, cursing and swearing is not what we think cursing and swearing is. Cursing would be the idea of calling down a curse from God. He must have said something like this. May God strike me dead if I know that man. Something like that. You do that all the time. Cross my heart and hope to die. You know, that's what he was doing. Boy, he was trying to back up his word any way he could. And the swearing part means that he was taking an oath. So he wasn't using slang cuss words. Man, he's calling down God, the heavens, the powers that be, that he's telling the truth. And right in the middle of it, he's lying like a dog. Peter lying like a dog. That's what he's doing. At that moment, for the second time, a cock crowed. Now friends, this cock crowing, I'm from Houston. We didn't have many cocks around my house. We didn't There wasn't any chickens for a long way in Houston. I don't understand about cocks crowing. I know they crow around sunlight a whole lot. But this, in Jerusalem, these chickens crow at a particular time. Matter of fact, the third watch of the night from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock is called the cock crow. These chickens apparently crow sometime between 12 and 1. Not a real sustained long crow, but they crow for some reason at that time. They crow again around 3 o'clock a.m. Now, Jesus had told Peter that you'll deny me before the cock crows twice. Now, for a Jew, that was locking into a time element as well as just saying that a chicken's going to crow and you're going to know it. He was even saying between 12 and 3 sometime, you're going to deny me three times. Now, so the cock crows a second time. Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, before the cock crows twice, you will disown me three times. And he remembered and burst into tears. Luke 22:61 says, and the Lord looked at Peter. Now here's, I think, the semblance. He went to Caiaphas for the first he went to Ananias for the trial, a brief questioning before him by the Roman soldiers. The Roman soldiers leave at that point. The Jewish temple police take him to Caiaphas. They have a mock trial. The trial is over. Jesus is condemned to death. They take Jesus to a holding cell for a few hours, and then in chapter 15:1, they have another trial of the whole Jewish Sanhedrin to officially pronounce the verdict they've already got to that night. When Jesus was on his way from this first interrogation to the prison cell in the courtyard is when he saw Peter. Now, folks, Jesus wasn't too pleasant to look at. Isaiah 53:52 says that he was beat up so badly that he didn't look like a man. And I don't know how bad he was beat up. But wouldn't it got Peter that the Lord, who he said he had died for, who he tried to die for in the garden, is now a bloody pulp. But he looks at Peter with love and says, Peter, I told you. And Peter remembers all those things that Jesus had said. Remember when Jesus said to him, Peter, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. But I've prayed for you, Peter. And when you turn back, feed my sheep. All that came back to Peter. And the Bible says he burst into tears and left. I think, again, it's prophetic prophecy of the condition of Jesus in Isaiah 52:14. And now Peter has gone out for the roughest night of his life. Peter did not go to the trial before Pilate or Herod. Peter did not apparently go to the crucifixion. And the next time Jesus saw Peter is where? John 21 on the lake of Galilee. Peter has gone back to fishing, but Jesus would not let him go. Questions and comments? Anybody? Let's bow our heads if we could for a moment. I want you to think just for a moment exactly what price that Jesus was willing to pay for you. He knew all of this years and months before it came about. But he was willing to drink this cup of judgment for you. I want you to know tonight that Jesus loves you. I want you to see him deserted by his friends. I want you to see him in the middle of an unjust trial. I want you to see him willing to take that kind of abuse, to be spit in his face, to be beat up for fun because of his love for you. I want you to see what we've studied tonight against the backdrop of Isaiah 52:53. All of that was not just happening. It was foreordained. He was taking your place. That should have been you. Those stripes should have been your stripes. And those bruises should have been your bruises and my bruises.
We hope you enjoyed today's verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study. If you would like a free outline of today's lesson, please write us at Bible Lesson, Box 1289,
Yes, they do. In my opinion, they do. No, I think it's way back from creation. I think that was one example I used of God limiting himself to man's free will. Now, you say, well, couldn't God overcome it? Well, sure, God can do anything, but God has limited himself not to respond except where faith is present. That's why I think in all the healings, Jesus took him aside and talked to him. You know, one old guy, he spit on the ground, made putty, and put it in his eyes, said, can you see anything? The guy said, well, I can't see very good yet. Jesus did it all over again, you know. He had the power to say, be gone, and it could, but he worked with him, you see. So I think it does saying that God has limited himself. It's not that God sends people to hell. God has limited himself not to work except in the area of faith, and therefore men, as their own recourse, have chosen that direction, and God has chosen not to stop what they want to do.